The following podcast is brought to you by The Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Well, good evening, everybody. It's just wonderful to see you all here again. Welcome if you're new. And I need to say a special welcome to my parents who are here this evening. And I'm just so touched and delighted. And it's made me a little more nervous than I might normally be. So we'll see how this goes. But I really am delighted to see all of you. Today was cool, just like it's been the last couple of days with that very clear, brisk autumn sky. And it feels like that beginning, the end of fall, the beginning of winter, that real moment when the seasons start to change, where I really notice them. And so that's kind of an entry in a way for me to what comes next. And I think as a society, as a culture in the United States, we have traditionally taken this end of fall, beginning of winter, change of season with Thanksgiving, where we eat food with our family and celebrate the fruits of the harvest and give thanks. Now, I don't know about you, but for me, this holiday is fraught. It's a little bit fraught, I imagine, for many of us on the personal level, because it's complicated. Families are complicated. Dynamics are complicated. The food can be complicated. You know, it just can have various reasons why we might feel some extra stress or various emotions around this time of year. And then culturally, I think it's complicated. I think we were all taught a sort of myth about what this holiday means, the Wampanoag greeting the pilgrims and helping them through, you know, their first winter. And isn't that wonderful? Except we know that the results of that were far-reaching and devastating for many, many, many people who are no longer here and continue to be devastating for many people that are still here. And so I think when we really think about this holiday, sometimes it can be hard to wrap our mind around a joyous celebration. And then I think this year, it's even more complicated because, of course, we're in the middle of this pandemic and we're not necessarily able to be with the people that we're close to or that we normally celebrate with or that we want to celebrate with. And there's a general feeling of stress and anxiety in the air right now, whether or not we're feeling that way ourselves at any one moment. And I think it makes it harder to enter into the kind of lighthearted spirit. And so I think it's great that I have an opportunity to sort of talk about this in the context of Fusatsu, which, as many of you know, we often, it's a ceremony, it's a renewal of vow ceremony that we often do on Thursday nights. And so that's what I'm going to be talking about tonight. So, as I said, Fusatsu is a renewal of vows, and it goes through several different steps. First step is a step of atonement, and we chant the verse of atonement, and we have a chance to look at and let go of the evil karma that we have accrued both as individuals and as part of a collective. And so that process of allowing ourselves to really come to terms with and know and acknowledge and be at one with the karma, our collective and individual karma, allows us to be able to release it. When we've done that, we're then in a state of being able to kind of fill up that empty space, which we do by chanting the names of the seven Buddhas, each of which is a reference and a symbol for a different beneficent quality that we want to have in our lives. And so I just want to say that, I think that we can get into, because time is linear and because we can't do everything all at once, we do first atonement and then the seven Buddhas. But in fact, I think that those two qualities of the emptying and the filling and the atonement and the beneficence really arise at the same time. And they are dependent on each other, and they're also independent of each other at the same time. And so we stand there in the middle of that, embracing those Buddhas while we're letting go of the evil karma that have inherited and that we have experienced. And then also from that place of standing there and being in the middle of these forces, we have a chance to recite our four vows, which is what we're going to say together at the end of this talk. The four vows of saving all sentient beings, of getting rid of our desires, getting rid of embracing all the dharmas. Those vows, which sort of form the backbone of our practice, we now can say from a place of the seven Buddhas and the relinquishing of our evil karma. And so in the ceremony, once we've passed through those three experiences, we then come to the point where we can say, well, how do I live that? And the how we live that is with the precepts. So I want to talk about today one particular precept, which is the precept of not killing. Now, I find this, for me personally, one of the most rewarding and kind of richest precepts to work with. And I think that the reason for me is because I tend to be a kind of mental person, is that I can really wrap myself into a lot of knots considering this precept from various angles. And so, to give you an example, even something as simple that says, we're going to not kill on the kind of, we're not going to kill, and what are we going to eat? We're going to eat vegetarian food, so we're going to not kill. But, that's just an interesting thing, because we know things now about plants, and I think we're kind of late to the game. I suspect that many other earlier civilizations than ours actually recognize that plants have a tremendous amount of vital energy and life force in them. And so, to conclude that that's not killing, but killing a turkey is killing, I think is problematic. And we have to do that because we have to live. But it's hard for me to see that doing that actually is not killing. But it's more complicated than even that, because I admit that we can probably agree that eating a carrot is going to cause less suffering than eating an animal. But let's just take, for example, something like the mosquito. Okay, so the mosquito is annoying, and we don't like them, and yet we can make a decision that we're not going to kill mosquitoes when they land on us. We'll shoo them away, or we'll wear DEET, and they won't land on us, and we'll take measures to avoid killing mosquitoes. But at the same time, I'm not sure that there's anybody here who would say that in a malaria-ridden country where the mosquitoes are deadly and where millions of people die every year because of mosquito bites that are with malaria, that we shouldn't be taking more active measures to actually kill them. And regardless of whether you or I are actually physically doing that killing, I think I at least feel that somehow killing mosquitoes under those circumstances is okay. And so I've sanctioned that particular piece of killing. Another example would be vaccines. So right now we are in a pandemic, which is constricting our lives, causing tremendous hardship around the country, around the globe. People are losing their jobs. Families are in turmoil. Children aren't to get educated. We all want this pandemic to end. And of course, the way forward to truly end this pandemic is going to be with a vaccine. So how do vaccines get made? Well, vaccines get made through a long, very dedicated scientific process during which the vaccines have to be tested. And before they are immediately tested on us, they have to be tested on animals. And that's true with all of our medicines and many other things as well. And so in order for us to have this vaccine, mice are going to have to be probably killed. I've heard they're using ferrets, and I don't know whether they also want to test this on monkeys or animals that are really very much like us. And so, you know, we find ourselves in this situation of having to be complicit to killing in order for us to survive. So how do we reconcile ourselves? Clearly, if we consider this precept in this kind of way that I've been talking, in a kind of logical and rational and intellectual way, it's impossible. We can't. We can never not kill, and we can never make choices based on our values about what is higher up on the level of our importance to us and what is lower down on the level of our importance to us. So there's a koan that actually talks about this a little bit, and so I'll tell you. A monk asked Chao Chu, "The ultimate path has no difficulties, just avoid picking and choosing." What is not picking and choosing? So the monk is coming to Chao Chu, and he's bringing up a very well-known saying, the ultimate way is without difficulty, just avoid picking and choosing, right? It's what I've been talking about now. We avoid picking and choosing, and we don't have to consider, you know, are we killing or not? We're on some level that's not involved on that level of detail. And the monk is saying, well, what's not picking or choosing, right? Whenever you think about it, you're making a choice. And it could be about something like this ethical question, but it could also just be like, what am I wearing today? You know, we go through our days picking and choosing based on our attractions, our aversions, how we feel, what we're thinking at this last moment, and we're making choices. So Chao Chu says, in the heavens and earth, I alone am the honored one. Now, this is a well-known expression that was said by Shakyamuni after his long night of sitting, wrestling with his demons, coming to a deep place of understanding and quiet, and he looks up at the morning star and wakes up. And this is what he says: in the heavens and on earth, I alone am the honored one. Now, actually, I've heard that what he said is actually something slightly different. There's this variant: I, together with all beings, am simultaneously enlightened. Well, those are the same thing. Okay, they just sound a little bit different. But I alone am the honored one. I, together with all beings, am simultaneously enlightened. And so he's directing us to that point that is actually outside of the picking and choosing. It's that awakening. When we're awake, we see our connection with all things, and we see our own enlightenment, our own awakening. But the monk's not satisfied. He's stuck in his mind, and he says, this is still picking and choosing, right? I mean, we can all say that. We can all say, as soon as you use words, you're having to make distinctions. As soon as you're saying this is enlightened, then you're already including the fact that there must be a not enlightened. And so, see, you're picking and choosing. And Chu says, stupid oath, where is the picking and choosing? And the monk was speechless. Where's the picking and choosing? So there are three commentaries that we typically look at with the precepts. And the first one is Bodhidharma. And so on the precept of not killing, Bodhidharma says, self-nature is subtle and mysterious. In the realm of the everlasting Dharma, not giving rise to the idea of killing is called the precept of not killing. So that first sentence, self-nature is subtle and mysterious. Bodhidharma says this at the beginning of all of his commentaries on each of the precepts. And that is, for me, the foundation on which he rests his understanding, which is the foundation of not knowing. We don't know. We don't know our own self nature. We don't know the self natures of other sentient beings. We don't know how history really unfolded, and we don't know where it's all going. And we don't know for a couple of reasons. One, because we're ignorant and we need to do our best to master that ignorance. But we also don't know because it's subtle and mysterious. And whenever you look at something from one side, you can look at it from the other. And it's not able to be explained rationally. We can't come to terms with it. We have to rest in a place of the big not knowing. Not the not knowing being ignorant, but the not knowing of not knowing. So I think that when you're in that place of not knowing, you can then find yourself in that idea, that place of non-discrimination, because not knowing naturally gives rise to not picking and choosing, not discriminating, and thus no idea of killing or not killing. So that's a very pure place to be. My one I would say, I don't know about problem, but the sort of caveat around that for me is that it's not necessarily the place that we can act from. So if you think for a minute about the samurai, story of the samurai is, you know, they practice, you know, diligently for many, many years, achieve a place of great oneness, have eliminated all those discriminations of killing and not killing. And so therefore, they're able to raise their sword and wield it flawlessly. There's no killing from the perspective of the samurai, but from the perspective of the parent or the sibling or the spouse or the loved one, somebody's dead. And so we can't use that to guide our actions. So I think that here is where Dogen is able to offer some more insight. Dogen says, the Buddha seed grows in accordance with not taking life. Transmit the life of Buddha's wisdom and do not kill. So Dogen makes it very clear that we're not staying in a static place. He uses words like growth, transmitting. There's movement here. We can't just stay stuck in some place of oneness that Bodhidharma was referring to. You know, it's why Shakyamuni, after having his experience, then went on to teach for the rest of his life. We need to be able to act. And when we act with the intention of not killing, and the more we don't kill, the more those two things come together in an expression of not killing. So again, here, there's not a before and not an after. It's a mutually arising phenomena of transmitting Buddha's wisdom and practicing not killing. And then Zen Peacemaker says, recognizing that I am not separate from all that is, this is the precept of non-killing. And here I think we get closer to the how. How do we do what Dogen suggests and what Bodhidharma suggests? We know we're not separate. We're not separate from the Native Americans, and we're not separate from the colonizers. We're not separate from our family, and we're not separate from the turkey or the carrot. And we recognize that, and then we act. We act to the best of our ability at that moment. And so from here, I think this leads naturally to the final part of the Fusatsu ceremony. And this is the gatha on the adoration of the three treasures, the Buddha, the Dharma, and Sangha. Ultimately, we are not separate from that. They are us, and we are it. This is where naturally gratitude arises from, and where we can go and celebrate Thanksgiving from this place of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Thank you.